This is a podcast from the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at UNSW Sydney. For more information, go to www.caldorcentre.unsw.edu.au.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I want to really thank our hosts and our friends, Francis and Tristan, who put this amazing program together. I also want to acknowledge the audience. We have so many experts in this room, and I want to make sure that in the end of the day, when we have discussion, we also expect the expert in the room to answer some of these questions and not just us in the panel. Also, we have special audience, actually the parent of Jackie, who's, I just heard that for the first time they are watching her speak. So I'm no pressure on Jackie today. But our parents for sure keep us humble. I think I want to also say that please be patient with us. We have been jet lagged. 17, 18 hours of travel is no joke. So if you see any of us react little today, just be patient and keep it. I hope also the recording will not be shared widely. And lastly, I want to just really acknowledge the generosity of the community here. I learned today that when you say you are having tea, it's not just tea, it's a lot of food. And I had the best Iraqi food today in Australia. So really thankful for the generosity of the community. So Professor Jane really shared a little about the CRCP, and I want to really give you a little summary about what we are going to go over in the next 3 days, as some of you might be already attending, some of you might just heard about it today. So the 2024 Consultation on Resettlement and Complementary Pathway, CRCP, aimed to address the increasing global displacement and resettlement needs. Led by Australia, this year's focus on advancing the 2030 roadmap, aiming to expand resettlement opportunities and complementary pathways for refugees. Key themes include enhancing resettlement capacity, integrating refugee perspective into decision-making, and promoting community support for resettlement by highlighting its positive impact. The consultation will explore challenges, share best practices, and seek innovative solutions to improve refugee integration and protection worldwide. I also want to share, if we are successful today, our panel discussion will address critical questions surrounding the current state and future prospect of resettlement on complementary pathway for refugees. Jackie will provide an assessment of progress and challenges in meeting UNHCR's strategic goal, while Mohammed will focus on the Biden administration efforts and potential impact of political changes in the USA. And Colm will explore the role of complementary pathways in refugee protection and solution, particularly in relationship to resettlement. And we will have enough time to really hear from you and answer your questions. So I will start with Jackie. And this is a complex of a question, so feel free to take what you want to take. So key strategic priority of UNHCR has been to expand the availability of resettlement and complementary pathways for refugees, with the aim that between 2019 and 2030, over 1 million refugees will benefit from resettlement, and over 2 million refugees will be admitted through complementary pathways. Meeting these goals is contingent upon countries stepping up and doing a lot more. But what we are often seeing is either stagnation, or in the case of some EU countries and others, retreat from these types of commitment. What is your assessment of the current state of play on resettlement and complementary pathway? And if you can give a complementary pathway one-on-one, that will be great.
So hello, everybody. And really, just to multiply the thanks and the appreciation for the welcome at absolutely every level. I think this has been a fantastic couple of days. And we're really looking forward to the conversations that will now take place here in Sydney with people from all over the world, and in fact, dialing in a couple of times as well. One complementary pathways. Just to start at the very basics, what we're looking at, and any question that we talk about refugees, we're looking at protecting people against being forced to go back to a place where they are in danger of being persecuted for a selection of reasons. So anytime we think about what we're trying to do in the asylum space, we have to start with the fact that asylum systems need to function. People need to be able to cross borders, they need to be able to ask for protection, and they need to be able to rely on that protection for the duration of the time that it's dangerous for them to go home. Full stop. The Refugee Convention talks about the end of refugee status, the cessation of refugee status, in terms of where people might find national protection, because that's ultimately what we're looking for, right? A solution to refugee status is when somebody is able to rely on a durable legal status that ensures national protection of all of their rights, economic, social, cultural, civil, and political. So many people, most people from the beginning want to go home. Most people want to go voluntarily home. They want their own country to fix its problems and for them to be able to rely on the protections of their state and of their civil society. And over time, most refugees have actually been able to go home. Difficult numbers today. We're not looking at great numbers in terms of people able to return. The other cessation clauses talk about when people find national protection elsewhere, either in their country of first asylum or in a third country, or indeed a fourth or a fifth country down the track. Resettlement has always been, since UNHCR was created in 1950, part of our job. We have worked with states and over time have referred millions, literally, of people who have left, first of all, war-torn Europe and then all the way around the world. The Indochinese, the CPA, was the largest. Most recent, the largest, millions of people left Vietnam and that area and ended up in countries like Australia. Over that time, people were selected on the basis of strategic need, part of a comprehensive solution, part of a plan that would allow hosting countries to not be overwhelmed by the number of people who need to access services, who need to be within their systems. What happened in the 1990s was that when the places went down, we started to focus on people with the most urgent protection needs. It makes sense. If you are really in need of being in a hospital or in a safe place, if you're a woman with lots of kids and you're at risk, then of course we want to try and prioritize your arrival in a place where you're going to be able to rely on those national services and systems. But ultimately, from a strategic point of view, all of us want to see 37 million, 44 million, depends on how you count the numbers, but there are millions of refugees out there and there aren't enough return options available. We know that refugees have capacity. We know that refugees are already, we know that they're resilient just by crossing a border and rebuilding their lives. Complementary pathways are intended to be complementary to asylum, complementary to resettlement that was designed for protection or for strategic purposes. The purpose of complementary pathways is to give refugees access to the global migration system without having to lose their international protections, without having to give up that protection against return to danger. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Very quickly, answering the question, it isn't UNHCR's strategy, it's all of our strategy. The consultations agreed in 2018, that we would aim for 1 million people resettled before the end of 2030, and 2 million people moving via complementary pathways, via these protective migration systems. You can say that we're doing well, you can say we're not. Actually, resettlement, we're at about 28%, which is kind of on course. If we manage to stay the course, we've got 2,500 people who have moved. This is departures, not submissions, many more submissions, which means there are numbers of people waiting to go through the process. Complementary pathways is even more, right? So if we're looking just at OECD numbers, so that's 27 countries, and we're only looking at the seven most significant asylum producing countries, then we're looking at about 750,000 people who have moved through regular migration and who are reported through national systems who are moving on complementary pathways. We're at about 38%. Those are the tip of the iceberg. Most refugees, I've been in five countries in the last couple of weeks. Australia has no idea where I was.
That's a good thing. Most refugees, if they're able to travel on a travel document that protects them, if they're able to come and go with exit visas and entry visas, most refugees should be able to move around the world without anybody tracking them. So what we're counting is actually significantly under. I think we can be hopeful. We've seen countries that have had trouble with housing. We've seen countries that have had trouble with all sorts of things coming online, coming and growing, shrinking, growing and shrinking. It's a normal part of the way that resettlement and indeed complementary pathways works. I think we have to keep the course.
Thank you so much, Jackie. And I'm sure we will come back with more questions. In the meantime, I want to go with Mohammed. So going back to the United States, so historically, the USA has been the largest provider of resettlement places for refugees and has also played a significant role in facilitating complementary pathways. What progress has the Biden administration has made to the expansion and equality of provision of resettlement and complementary pathways? And what challenges have you identified along the way? Also, in November this year, USA will hold its next federal elections. And there is the possibility that Trump may be elected for a second time. How would a change of government in the USA impact the global provision of resettlement and complementary pathways? So double questions.
Yeah, it's the easiest question on the block. I saw a few heads shaking right here in the front row. So it's certainly a challenging time in the United States, and it has been for the last 4 years. But it's all to say that no matter the efforts of the previous administration over the last 4 years, there has been a rebuild of the traditional resettlement infrastructure across the United States. But really, to answer that question more sort of fully, the United States over the last 4 years has dealt with significant challenges. And I often like to sort of, I think about it in dimensions, and really the resettlement and complementary pathways infrastructure, I think about it in sort of four response points, right? One is, of course, our traditional resettlement program is set every single year. There's a presidential determination. And over the last few years, the presidential determination has been 125,000 refugees. That's effectively the goal of the administration to resettle. Last year in fiscal year 23, we only resettled about 60,000. So about half of what was originally intended. This year, fiscal year 24, it's the same presidential determination. So it's 125,000. The hope is, and actually amongst many of my colleagues, that we could potentially meet that quota, especially if you combine with some of the sort of complementary pathway efforts. The second sort of dimension of how we've been operating in the United States is, of course, innovations in the field. The Welcome Corps program, which my colleague here, Basma, is sort of, you know, leading across the United States, that has been a really significant part and has really contributed, I think, to organizing and energizing local community members to really engage critically and fundamentally, both in sort of, you know, post-arrival support, but certainly I think it's shaped some of the public opinion around the country as it relates to the public's responsibility for engaging and really, I think, sort of embracing sort of refugees in local community settings. And then, of course, there were the challenges faced with the evacuation, the fall of Kabul. The United States originally accepted roughly around 79 to 81,000 Afghans. That number is eclipsed, I think, closer now to 120,000 Afghans across the United States. That's a pretty significant number. And then, of course, Ukrainians, there are about 217,000 now Ukrainians who've been provided humanitarian parole status, so protected status, temporary as it is, but it's protected status at least. 117,000 of those folks were brought by the United for Ukraine program. So when you think about those numbers, 217,000 Ukrainians, 120,000 Afghans, that's 350,000 just from a response perspective. Then you think about the resettlement infrastructure and the number of refugees that have been brought to the United States. And then, of course, some of the other complementary pathways, family reunification and others for Afghans and so forth. That all happened at a moment when the administration was rebuilding the infrastructure. So I think the United States has, I think, done as well as one could hope in an environment where really the resettlement infrastructure was fundamentally and technically decimated. And it's not just from the perspective of how the government itself decimated the infrastructure. But at the same time, because that had happened, you saw local resettlement agencies close shop. You saw nonprofits not able to raise money for their work. So really, we're talking about the entire architecture of the resettlement program, not just that which was government-led, but that which was all civil society-led, and then, of course, community organizations and so forth. Now, to rebuild that in 4 years, it's not possible, right? But the fact of the matter is there was enough enthusiasm and energy and focus and conviction to want to build that. And I think that's a really strong message for us, particularly as governments, you know, sort of cycle their ways between sort of conservative and sort of more liberal sort of central governments. The final point here is we, of course, have a pretty, you know, pretty large southern border. And that comes with its own complications. We're dealing with quite significant complications right now at the U.S. southern border. There's been a rightward shift in our politics as it relates to asylum law. And the reason I'm stating that, although it's outside the sort of traditional realm of resettlement, is that public opinion in the United States is deeply shaped by what happens at the border. And what often doesn't get counted enough or discussed enough is that the public's perception of what occurs in and around the southern border has downstream consequences for public support for resettlement programs, because the narratives of chaos have a powerful grab, they're a powerful and generating force in shaping scarcity and security mindsets. And so I mentioned that because a lot of my training is in strategic communications. And so we think a lot about the ways in which those narratives ultimately influence and shape the kind of, you know, sort of long-standing enduring protection programs that we really need to be able to respond to emergency crisis, but at the same time build complementary pathways for those who can provide considerable sort of national sort of support, right, across our economies and so forth. And the point around the Trump administration, I mean, they've been pretty explicit, I think, in some of their public correspondence around what it is that they might want to do. And I think that it's going to be a significant challenge, but a challenge nonetheless that certainly I know that, like many of us are up for, certainly I am up for, but just because of conservative government comes into place, it doesn't mean that the entire system all of a sudden goes kapoof, right? And I think we have to do what we can to be able to protect the kinds of mechanisms that cement enduring protection for many of us, including my own family many, many years ago. So it's a complicated picture, is sort of what I'm saying, but also a hopeful one. And not to lose sight of that fact. It's easy to be cynical about this work. It's tougher to be hopeful. But the fact of the matter is, what I've seen in the last 4 years is extraordinarily hopeful. And it gives me a lot of, I think, it keeps me ambitious. You know, it keeps me awake. Just not the last few days, because I've been on 18-hour flights.
I mean, so true. And I think I was reflecting when I heard Mohammed sharing about the resilience of our communities as well, and how we step in when we see a federal government closing the door. We as communities step in. I started actually joining this work back in 2016, 2017, when the Muslim ban happened in the United States, leaving my full-time teaching career and taking this as an opportunity for me to educate the community about the work and why it's important to continue welcoming refugees, as I am one of them. So I see in time of struggle, a lot of hope comes in and more people step in to support. Thank you so much, Mohammed. Going to Colm. So again, going to this week marks a working group meeting in Sydney of the Global Consultation on Resettlement and Complementary Pathways. These consultations were formerly known as the Annual Tribute Consultation on Resettlement, but have since been renamed to include emphasis on complementary pathways, and to no longer limit the consultation to tribute structures. In your view, how do complementary pathways such as community sponsorship, labor, or education pathways advance protection and solution to refugees? And how do resettlement and complementary pathways relate to one another? And are there any points of friction in this?
Lots of questions in one go there again. And if you'll indulge me for a moment, I might just follow on from some of what Mohammed said.
to just remind us to not buy into some of the narratives that we see in the media and political sphere, right? The narratives that tell us what the discourse is on these issues can very often be very different to what's happening at the community level or at the level of the social. Now, they have massive implications because right. That's where policy and legal decisions get made. That's where programs either get dismantled or created, mm-hmm. right? So it has a massive impact on the capacity of community and of society to respond in a more open and more generous way. But there can be a temptation, I think, sometimes to imagine that initiatives like complementary pathways or community-based welcome or community sponsorship or significant progress in these areas is dependent upon liberal or progressive political right. forces, you know, right. being dominant. And yet we've seen in many countries, I mean, in Australia, it was a Conservative government who first took the first steps towards establishing a community sponsorship program. In the UK, it was a Conservative government in a very toxic political sphere, or in the midst of very toxic political discourse on migration and refugees, that introduced a community sponsorship program in the UK. Now, the US is, at least in this regard, fairly exceptional. I get that the circumstances and it's very personality based, so we're in a different set of circumstances. Mm. But I suppose when you ask about what can they bring to the discussion, well, look what they did in the United States, like complementary pathways. If we see community sponsorship or community-based welcome initiatives as a complementary pathways, well, they built capacity
yeah.
to achieve extraordinary things in a country where the resettlement system had been pretty much dismantled right. by the previous administration. And there is, of course, the hope that that means they've built systems now and levels of public support that will be resilient, hopefully, or more resilient should an incoming administration seek to dismantle them. Because I think it's fair to say in the United States, as in many, many countries, community initiatives to welcome and receive migrants are not—they're not partisan. They're bipartisan or multipartisan in many, many cases. It's a myth to imagine that it's only progressive liberals or those who identify as progressive liberals who have a concern for refugees or for welcoming refugees. It's simply not true, and I think we need to do more to counter some of that as well. It's not in any way going to diminish the risk of so-called strongman leaders who want to come in and use this issue, instrumentalize this issue to create division, to dismantle. That's a very, very real and pressing risk. But I think it's one of the strengths of community-based, in particular, welcome initiatives. Of course, the other thing, and for me, one of the very exciting things about complementary pathways is it's a game changer in terms of refugee agency. You know, you're in a very different set of circumstances when a displaced person needs a protection opportunity. There's a very different experience for somebody who has access to a complementary pathway as a solution, as a protection solution, versus somebody who has to go through a UNHCR referred program or the kind of resettlement programs that we work with many states in putting in place. Because in that context, a displaced person or refugee is told, here's where you're going, here's what will be provided, here's how you need to engage with that system, here's the support mechanisms that will exist with you. And frankly, they have to comply with those mechanisms to access protection. There are good reasons for that, right? But if you look at a complementary pathway, suddenly you're in a situation where somebody is seeking an opportunity. They're applying for a job. They're choosing to accept or not accept that job. They're choosing both the place they will go to live, the country they will go to live, and the employment opportunity that they will take. If we then think about the area that I'm very interested in on the community side, because we do a lot of work on community sponsorship, it's interesting to talk about the implications of complementary pathways for how we think about community-based welcome and community reception. Again, if somebody is coming through a community sponsorship program, there's a mechanism through which they access support. If somebody is arriving through a complementary pathway program like Labour, they may choose not to seek or receive those kind of formal resettlement supports. So I think one of the big game changers in complementary pathways is the degree of agency that exists then for refugees. And I think that's transformative, both for individual people and their families who access protection through that mechanism, but also I think quite frankly transformative for the system. And I think that's a positive thing. It's going to require the system to flex, to adapt, if it is to scale in that regard. It's also transformative for the communities that are welcoming and receiving and working to support the resettlement of those refugees. Because again, complementary pathways require the involvement very often of community-based models of support and resettlement and integration. So they're empowering pathways that massively increase the agency of refugees and of welcoming communities, whilst of course as well, enormously contributing to the scaling of programs. I mean, if you look at the targets, the target is 1 million people through resettlement and 2 million people through complementary pathways, which takes me to the next question that you asked about the idea of whether there is there friction between the pathways. I mean, if there is, it's because there isn't sufficient imagination on the part of those of us who are working to put in place these pathways to think differently about how we approach the work. Of course there isn't. We're talking about building out systems of protection that over the period 2019 to 2030 can provide protection for 3 million people. We talk about 1 million people through a settlement, 2 million people for complementary pathways. There's no suggestion of conflict there. Conflict and tensions where they exist really are about how do we begin to adapt the systems and the processes that we use to provide both access to pathways, be it a traditional resettlement pathway or complementary pathway, and then on the back end, on the reception end, how do we flex, adapt, and reorientate our reception capacity to be able to support those pathways? Those are not tensions, right? They're challenges. Tensions may arise within them, but I think if they become tensions, we need to look a little bit deeper about what might be motivating those tensions, because like there's no good reason for them to exist. There are challenges, there are struggles, there are difficulties. It'll require adaptations, but I think there'll be valuable and rich adaptations that will strengthen protection overall if we get it right.
Thank you, Colm. And always inspiring to hear your movement building around community sponsorship. And I also want to shout out, is it community sponsorship team here who are leading the work in Australia here, I heard today. If you can stand up, please.
Over here,
just want to make sure that we give them a great shout out for all of the work that they are doing. So, and actually, I am here if you have any questions after about the Welcome Corps and the establishment of community sponsorship in the US, just in numbers, since January 2023, the program was launched, and we have over 40,000 Americans stepped in to say, I want to sponsor a refugee. So it's been amazing to see how many people have the willingness to welcome and support in resettlement and welcoming work. Going back to Jackie, so UNHCR indicate that the Asia region has the highest estimated resettlement needs of any region in 2024. Numbering nearly 730,000 refugees. This amount to 30% of the global needs and reflect the significant resettlement needs of refugees and refugees from Afghanistan and Myanmar. How is the strategic use of resettlement being deployed in the Asia-Pacific region? And what are the challenges and what are the opportunities for governments and stakeholders?
When we do the annual global for the projected needs, we have a whole process every year, and we try to figure out how we can break down the individual needs of people who really need to be gone, you know, yesterday, where we would need to have places for dossier submission, so distance decision making, interviewers won't need to necessarily get on a plane. We need to maybe set up a safe house. And we do have countries, Norway's in the team today, not here tonight, I think, but there are countries that have given thousands and thousands of places over the years to departures within 48 hours, departures within a week. Australia can do the same thing. We submitted from UNHCR from 96 operations last year to 24 resettlement countries, 150,000 people, 155,000 people. For resettlement consideration. A significant number of those were identified. I mean, those countries, fewer than half of those countries had specific resettlement quotas or indeed resettlement staff. This is people who were identified by protection staff as being in need of going. However, the majority of the people who moved were moved because there was a recognition by resettlement countries around the world that the departure of a number of people, maybe it's 2,000, maybe it's 5,000, maybe it's 10 or 20,000, would have an impact on the host country's ability to offer inclusion in national services and to maintain their open borders. So in those numbers, and open borders, including to the United States, thank you very much. And so those numbers and those places were provided because there was a real commitment to moving forward. The largest numbers of people who were listed as having projected needs for next year, for this year, in the Asia Pacific region are Afghans and are the Rohingya. We've now, the United States launched it, but Australia and Canada and Ireland, I don't know who's else in the room, we've got a number of different countries now stepping up to offer places to the Rohingya. And that has opened the door for conversations with the government of Bangladesh, just as resettlement over the years has maintained conversations with the government of Malaysia, the government of Jordan, the government of Lebanon. These are Turkey, you know, these are the largest refugee hosting countries in the world, and they are committed. Pakistan said last year at our standing committee, you need to make that 2030 quota. You need to get 1 million people resettled because we're overwhelmed. And so everything we do, whether it's working with the World Bank or, you know, trying to build hospitals for local communities to which refugees have access, we need to be, and we are getting smarter about, if you build a hospital, it makes a lot of sense for us to then resettle everybody with a chronic medical condition so that hospital doesn't get overwhelmed. Right. And resettlement countries are already and need to do more to make that connection between the strategic goals of a region. And we're now in Australia. This is, of course, the Asia Pacific region. They're working very closely with different regional bodies, different structures to try and figure out how they can find solutions for as many people as possible. Resettlement may be a relatively small number, although we're proud of the 100,000 people who left last year. Thank you very much. But nonetheless, a relatively small number in all of that, but they can, despite the small numbers, they can have a really important public impact in countries that are hosting the largest number of people. Even a small number of departures can have a really significant impact on a willingness of a country to maintain borders. And I will say, I was in Eastern Congo during the pandemic. Congo never closed its borders. 7 million internally displaced people, a country with no medical system. They have 500,000 refugees from countries all around the region, from 7 different countries, and the borders never closed. So we're talking about a need to offer solidarity to some of the most generous people, some of the poorest people, and some of the most generous countries in the world, despite what we might hear about them. So within the Asia Pacific region, the thing that I was asked to raise, and I think it's important for us to talk about it, yes, resettlement, yes, we need to go in and get as many Rohingya out as we can, but the complementarity of whether it's labor mobility or education mobility or some sort of hybrid program where, you know, maybe there's a place for a lottery whereby people would be able to sign up to go and live in a rural area, fill some of the empty houses in places where there isn't a housing shortage. We need to think creatively about how we give people opportunities to demonstrate their resilience in another place and to build their lives and their community lives. So, but in order to do that, in many cases, what we need is to really look at the systems and the structures. Resettlement, and the big difference between resettlement and what we're sort of lumping together as complementary pathways, is exactly what Colin was talking about. It's about agency. Resettlement is something that we do for essentially people. Complementary pathways is when people get to demonstrate what they can already do. However, right now there are legal and practical barriers to people being able to make those choices. We are not able, I have an Australian passport. It's a magical thing. I can not need a visa, or I can get a visa really easily if I want to work or travel somewhere. If you're a refugee, the first question that a visa officer is going to ask is, are you going to want to stay? So a refugee travel document, and by the way, these are 100 years old. These were literally in 1922, the first refugee and stateless travel documents were issued. The point was to give them the opportunity to be treated like everybody else, just ordinary people traveling around the world doing what people do. Human beings migrate, human beings move. So we're working on trying to make sure that every refugee gets a machine readable travel document that allows them return to their country of first asylum. And that is therefore allows them to be considered on the same basis as the hosts of their country of asylum. So if you're in Zambia, if you're in Uganda, if you're in Kenya, these are countries that issue machine-readable travel documents that match our criteria here in Australia and that allow people to apply for visas. And then at the end of their work, they get to go back to the country of asylum. They get to visit their mother, She'll do the laundry. She's very nice about that. You know, they get to bring their remittances. They get to contribute to that host community. They get to be seen as just an ordinary human being in 2024. And once again, they don't have to worry about us. They can completely ignore UNHCR. And for us, that's really the win. So in Asia, if we can start to see, you know, the Philippines has offered to help people go and learn nursing, to learn, you know, it's not only about construction. There are women out there doing things in traditionally, in areas that are traditionally held by women. The Philippines has offered to support refugees in the region to gain the skills and to get themselves accredited in a way that is then recognized by destination countries. But we need a whole series of things to happen. We need travel documents, we need visas, we need accreditation, we need countries to be open to refugees coming and not necessarily being too sticking around. We need to make sure that countries of asylum feel comfortable with the idea that refugees might come back, even if only temporarily. And that requires us to really work on those systems together.
Really resonate, and I think the message is clear. We need resettlement and complementary pathway to get to the goal. And I think really important to say, hearing that even during the time of COVID, UNHCR employees were working hard everywhere. And it's a really, I want to make sure we give shout out to the UNHCR in the room. Staff, please stand up, because we really appreciate the work you are doing on the ground and having time to convene us also in spaces. Everyone deserves a recognition here. Going back to Mohammed, so you are currently co-chairing the CRCP, Refugee Advisory Group. In your review, how have refugees, both individually and through their chosen representative, been included in the design and delivery of resettlement and complementary pathways? And how successful has this been, and what further work is needed?
Yeah, I'm gonna do another shout out.
yeah, let's keep it going.
Yeah, for those of you who are refugees here in the audience, if you could just stand up or raise your hands, that'd be really excellent. I'm looking at y'all. I know who you are. So, all right, we have a few there on the left and the right. Yeah, you definitely count, Farah. Yeah, former refugees. Yeah, not her. Yeah. Kids. Yeah. Former refugees. Great. Yeah. Sorry. I think it's been a journey. Let's just start there. On the one hand, I think I'd like to start off with what Sokhan mentioned, as well as sort of my colleagues in and around agency, right? I think part of, and just to give you a bit of a background, I'm a former refugee. My family left Afghanistan in 1984, 85. My father was granted political asylum in the US in 1988. Then we came by family reunification in around the mid 90s. And so I was quite young. And so that certainly had a lot to do with my ability to be able to, you know, to be able to sort of move through the system in the United States. I'm so fairly privileged and lucky to have had that experience. But as I look at the sort of the ecosystem, I think the ecosystem has been on a journey, and I think it's happening at multiple levels. And I'll start at the most local level, because today we had just some remarkable site visits. We were at a community center, an Afghan-led community center, sort of a refugee-led organization that was doing some remarkable capacity building work. I mean, they had been involved in responding to the COVID crisis. They were doing English language courses. They had the full gamut and the full spectrum of programmatic services being delivered to that community. And then also certainly sort of in collaboration with other organizations. And so really what you have is you have the integration of these kinds of organizations at that level of post-arrival support. And I think that is cross-cutting across, like, geography. It's cross-cutting in the United States, certainly. That was a really strong element of our response to what happened in Ukraine, certainly for, you know, in receiving 120,000 Afghans. And I think that, like, that is a fundamental foundational anchor for refugee engagement and integration across the resettlement to complementary pathways architecture. That needs to be sustained. That needs to be resourced at the government and civil society level. And most importantly, and this came up certainly today, they need to be given the recognition that they rightly deserve. And I cannot state that enough. And so if you're working with the refugee-led organization, ensure that you recognize them. Recognize them in the ways that they want to be recognized, not in the ways that you think they should be recognized. And so that's sort of clarity number one, sort of point of clarity number one. The second is that states themselves are developing mechanisms because they fundamentally believe that now what you've had is if you've had, you know, many decades of, you know, accepting or sort of providing enduring protections to refugees, they've gone through school, they've gone through all of the elements. And many of us like Basma and myself, you know, we're not professionals in this field, you know, and the reason that I state that is I am not very interested in being an observer to the system. So if you want me to observe, don't invite me. I won't come. I'm honest. I'm just really frank about that. I'm an equal. I expect to be treated that way. And so we want to be engaged technically. And that's really fundamental because we care a deep amount about the technicalities around ensuring that there's efficiency and there's success in these systems. And so that leads me to sort of what UNHCR has been doing across the board. I'll start with the Global Refugee Forum, over 300 plus refugees. Where they're out of a total attendees of 4,800, but progress is progress, right? At the last GRF was about 70 plus, and so. But then at the mechanism level, specifically with the CRCP, there's a refugee advisory group, and this group is made up of 20 experts who are former refugees who have different sets of competencies. Some in research, some in the technicalities around post-arrival support services, some on sort of policy frameworks, et cetera. But they effectively are then put in positions to be successful and to advance some of the core fundamental streams of work that UNHCR is doing in and around the consultations. And I think that it's kudos to UNHCR for building that kind of mechanism, but really integrating that mechanism within the life cycle of the policy making and the policy framework making. And I think that's really, really essential. Again, and mechanisms like this, effectively, they only are successful to the extent that they're embedded into the policy-making process. If you essentially just establish them for the sake of establishing them, that's not very efficient. It's also a waste of your resources, honestly. And so in effect, you know, like the technical integration, I think it's a fundamental next step in ensuring that that happens. You know, and that has to happen both at the domestic national level, but certainly at the multilateral level. We've seen some significant advancements in that area, and there are many colleagues who do that work here. So I do recommend you sort of to connect with them.
And the parent of Jackie, I'm sure you're so proud of the work that she's doing, and I know you have some comment about the refugee-led work that's happening.
I think one of the things that, and we were talking about this before, yeah. There's a real shift in the advisory panel role from a time when lived experience was enough to a time when we're really looking at refugee, you say you're not professional, nonsense. When we're looking at people who are professional and knowledgeable in all sorts of parts of this field, and we're able to bring that professional experience to bear with the lived experience woven through. And I think that has been the biggest shift for me with regard to the Global Refugee Forum. Right. The first Global Refugee Forum, we wanted refugees there, but we weren't really sure what we could do. And all of a sudden, we had, I mean, in fact, it was more than 300. Those were the 300 that we kind of funded. But we had a huge number of people who were lawyers, right? We've got hours and hours and hours of law firms offering free services in the next $1 billion, I think, of legal services. A huge number of those are people who happen to be refugees. And they're all the way through the work that we're doing. And I think that, for me, is a huge change and a great privilege. So now the next thing is to make sure that that's not just happening in the developed world and in the wealthy world. So one of the things that is a bit of a project that I would like to try and get off the ground. So you're in Australia, you get to lobby for this, please. Australia, Canada, and a couple of other countries have migration agent systems whereby a license is needed in order to be able to give migration advice. So one of the things that we've talked about with the Australian government, and I'm not promising on their behalf, but is the idea that there would be a sort of shorter and a more limited accreditation that would be able to be attributed to people after training in refugee hosting countries and refugee hosting areas, so that the people who don't want to go for third country solutions, and that might be people who are carers, who are looking after family, etc., but who do have the education and the capacity to build something where they are, might be able to put together
maybe it's an NGO, maybe it's a little for-profit deal with a schedule of payments to fill in forms for people who want to go on family reunification, to fill in forms for people who want to apply for visas. These are really complicated things to do. I stuff it up. If I do, then refugees certainly are going to. If we had a migration agent training program remotely supported by, we've talked about it with SSI this week, remotely supported by some local actors in the countries of destination, run by refugees, that would allow some refugees to stay and to work in the communities in which they've been living and allow other people to go and take up opportunities elsewhere, we start to see, once again, we start to see the possibility of UNHCR and our friends withdrawing. But more to the point, we start to see a much more sustainable system and a system that would allow people to make choices that are important for them on the basis of their requirements and their interests.
I think one of the things that's most excited me, particularly over the last couple of years, has been to see the shift away from talking about, you know, that phrase, meaningful participation of people with lived experience,
yeah,
to actually recognizing that it's not about participation, it's about leadership. If we don't have the expertise of people with lived experience leading in the development of solutions to resettlement challenges, I mean, what are we at, right? Just on a purely self, from a purely system serving perspective, what are we at? We can't advance in the way that we need to advance without that expertise. And then on a more principled or human rights-based perspective, a model that doesn't seek to fully recognize the agency and the capacity of people within a system, particularly people for whom a system is meant to exist and whose rights and needs it's meant to respond to, and instead that sees people as objects of pity or of charity, is deeply, deeply flawed from a principled perspective. I mean, that's an important piece to remember as well. And when we talk about expertise, I mean, I had a conversation with a doctor at home in Ireland last week, and she was, so we're working to try to advance some better solutions, in particular for Afghan doctors who came to Ireland over the last couple of years, because we had a significant number who arrived in the country. We have a shortage of general practitioners in Ireland. They've come up with an interesting model where doctors from overseas with qualifications can take an exam. If they pass the exam, then a certain number will get access to a two-year, effectively an internship or traineeship program where they'll work with the GP and then be qualified at the end of it. There were 300 places available and 1,500 people took the exam.
Yeah.
Right. So a country that has a huge deficit, right, a massive need for more and more doctors. There are 1,500 doctors who are, many of them are refugees, others are migrants, in the country, and we haven't come up with a solution that allows them to transfer their skill sets so that they can contribute and be fully who they are. I mean, it's a no-brainer on every single level. It's right from a human rights perspective, it's right from a principled perspective, it's right from a systems reform perspective, and it's obviously and simply just the right thing to do. But it is exciting to see how much the conversation has shifted from like observer status,
right,
to meaningful participation.
Right.
And I don't mean to be trite here, but you're seeing it on this panel this evening, right? That the most, in my view, exciting transformative voices that we're seeing operating in this space now are people who are speaking from a lived experience of a displacement, and the insights and the perspectives and the leadership that's being brought to these discussions is enormously transformative in my view. It's really, really exciting.
You know, and just to add sort of one last point, and fundamentally, I happened to stumble on sort of Caldor's recent report, or more recent report around principles in and around what are the principles that need to underlie the Australian sort of refugee protection system. Principle number 7 was around investing in the sort of the enduring leadership capabilities and capacities of refugees. And I think what that investment must also sort of consider is the kinds of resources that helps to skill up, right? Like the capacities of very much the refugees who want or would like to be able to be in the kinds of spaces that help to shape sort of the policy frameworks that ultimately sort of yield efficiencies, you know, and protections for themselves and their families and, you know, and their community members. And I think that is a fundamental part that I think often gets missed in the discussion. Right. And I know a number of my colleagues sometimes were extraordinarily capable, but they need a little bit of an extra kind of sort of support network, support framework to be able to really be effective. And I think that's not, that certainly is not lost on me.
And of course they do. I mean, who wouldn't, right?
Right.
If you step into another whole area of complexity, both from a law and policy perspective, and you don't come from that sphere, it's not because you're a refugee, it's because you're, like, who could simply operate without an additional level of support or capacity building in order to be able to do so?
And it's iterative. So we need to make sure that we're listening to people talk about what they found challenging. We need to make sure that we're in the place that can help them to weave their way. I'm looking at Linda and Eileen here, who 20 years ago, I think, started a network of women in the Asia Pacific region and got to the point where they were no longer coming to Geneva to push around states and UNHCR at annual meetings because the refugees were able to do it themselves and much more effectively. So, you know, we have history in this region, and UNHCR has been changed by it. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
Those women and men, but very many women, came looking like they were all so demure, and they shook us up. And I have to tell you, from inside the house, it's good, right? That's what we need.
I'm not sure they look that demure, to be perfect.
No, these guys weren't demure. And not even a little bit.
I mean, I don't mean that in a kind of genre.
The women they brought with them looked demure on day one.
Like, I'll also, I mean, just to, sorry, I know this portion of the panel, but Basma did, so Basma was, so the United States Refugee Advisory Board is a state-based mechanism in the United States, and she and I serve on that body. Basma was the first refugee in the history of the XCOM plenary, or the history of XCOM, to be able to offer or finish the remarks of the state delegation, and so she's Iraqi. And then just this last fall, I was also there in XCOM, sort of finishing, like, the U.S. intervention. And think about that. Over the last 20 years, the United States' largest wars have been in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the two people who offered closing interventions were both from Iraq and Afghanistan. That is extraordinarily powerful. It's not lost on me, the gravity of that, right? But at the same time, I also want to ensure that there's levels of accountability, both, like, there's bidirectionally. And I think the way that I think we as refugees or former refugees can hold ourselves accountable is we have to make sure that when we are representing, you know, in front of bodies like this and consultations or otherwise, that to ensure that the people that are representing or offering that kind of expertise are the right people to be in those spaces and chairs, right? And so I think that's really, really fundamental. And that's the way in which we as former refugees have to hold ourselves and our ecosystem accountable, right? We have to do our part in ensuring that we offer the most technical grounding in what it is that is expected of us, right? And so I think that that's a challenge to, you know, my colleagues in that space. And so, because you can't have accountability one way. And sometimes it is often about advocating UNHCR, advocating X, you know, government or so forth. But what about holding ourselves accountable in that same very vein and with the same levels of intensity and focus and conviction? That's really fundamental.
Yeah, chills.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't need to stop them because this is the most thing that we talk about. And it's, I feel like it's never enough to talk about refugees leadership and inclusion and making sure we center people with lived experience in decision-making. I also want to flag that Tristan in this room have amazing publication around refugees leadership and inclusion that I want to make sure that you read it. I spend my 17 hours of travel reading many of them, and I did not get tired, but there are some really good publication in the region about this topic, and I really appreciate all of what this center doing to make sure that refugees leadership centered in the work. I guess I am done with my question. I know one more question to you, Colm. It's up to you if you want to.
It's okay, I don't mind.
I know that
you should give him the hardest question.
I can see it. It's not the hardest.
You talked about it. Like, you talked about it, about how you handle it with the Afghan doctors and how you brought in the health sector into the work. Maybe speak a little about how complementary pathway bringing in a new, new partners who we did not think about it before in this work. And after that, we will take questions from the audience.
But by design, complementary pathways mean that you have to bring in new partners, and new partners as very active participants, both in the design, but then the implementation of the pathways. So an education pathway means that you have to bring in education pathways. You're working with institutions and educational institutions to be part of that process. If you're thinking about those pathways, then also being supported by a community-based welcome piece, you need agencies. So already you're diversifying the range of organizations, groups, and communities who are involved in resettlement. Yeah. And then similarly, obviously with Labour Pathway, you're bringing in employers, you're bringing in employment associations, you're bringing in the allied services that will need to support, you know, potentially provide some resettlement support there. You're also creating then, I think, relationships between various parts of that evolving and emerging ecosystem. So you have traditional settlement agencies working with agencies involved in community sponsorship, working with employers who are now receiving people through labor pathways or institutional, third level institutions receiving people through education pathways. And you're seeing a massive diversity in the range of agencies that are then involved. So obviously you see enormous diversity. Well, you certainly see enormous diversity beginning to come into the program. In terms of the impact, I mean, the impact of the work is extraordinary. I keep thinking back to my first experience of a complementary pathway in practice was going I used to work with Amnesty International in Ireland. I was the director there for many years. And we traveled to Canada to learn about Canada's sponsorship model, as so many people have done over the years. And I remember being in a building not unlike this, meeting with, I think it was KPMG in Canada. And they had done a very big program in response to the Syrian crisis. Where they had rolled out a community sponsorship program across their offices in Canada. And they recruited a huge number of people, raised lots of money and delivered lots of sponsorships within the program. And I remember the senior partner going, what they didn't consider was the impact that would have on their organization. Mm-hmm. So they did it because their people cared passionately and wanted to respond. And there was a mechanism that allowed them to do so. The other thing that complementary pathways do, they empower ordinary people to be powerful in a situation that's often presented as intractable, divisive, toxic, and hopeless. It doesn't make people powerful. It allows people to manifest the power that they have, to have enormous impact on their communities, on the lives of other people, and on the further development of their communities. But in doing so, they're also transformed. I mean, these pathways are transformative, not just, and principally, of course, we're concerned with the beneficiaries of pathways, right? The protection need is the overwhelming concern. But actually, they're incredibly transformative for those who get involved as well. I remember this partner in KPMG saying, what they didn't realize or understand was the impact and the positive impact it would have on their organization. So he said to me, we have lots of different disciplines. We've law, we've taxation, we've all of these different disciplines, and we have teams who operate within teams within these silos. Suddenly, we had sponsorship groups being established across the organization from across these teams, and with people working together on something that they cared passionately about and developing relationships that carried beyond the work. So suddenly across the organization, they saw extraordinary capacity and creativity being unleashed within their business community. And that's exactly what you see in communities or groups of people, be they an educational institution, be it the HSE in the UK, the NHS in the UK being so involved in labor pathways there with the recruitment and welcoming of many nurses from Palestine, actually, I think predominantly, and the upskilling of people upon arrival into the NHS system to have their qualifications recognized. So you see all of that capacity, you see all of that diversity, but then you see this incredible impact that is bigger than just the resettlement piece, which of course is enormously important and is at the heart of it all. It was a long-winded response, wasn't it? I said I'd be short. Yeah, there you go. Don't ask an Irishman to say something in short measure, ever. At least not this one.
I'm not Irish, but I have an Irish name, so I'm gonna try myself. I think maybe two things. One is that as the world of engagement, whether it's in community sponsorship or in NGO referrals or in, you know, coming and harassing UNHCR on a bi-yearly basis. One of the things, it keeps us on our toes. And I think you're absolutely right, Mohammed. Whoever we are, we need to be kept on our toes. But, you know, we're working in 136 countries, UNHCR. And the
The money just isn't there for the big collection of NGOs, be they local and community or international, to be alongside that process. But I have to tell you, the impact of, you know, a couple of the LGBTQI organizations that are pushing and pushing and poking and asking and, you know, this, what about this and what about that, are having a massive impact well beyond the maybe 6 or 7 countries that they're now really focusing on. They're having an impact in every single region where we work. And I think the more that we work across, the more that we expand, we've worked, UNHCR has always worked with communities. I've spent my entire life sitting under mango trees, talking to groups of women who do not hold back. But we haven't really made that connection with the communities here that are welcoming people at destinations for, yes, a small but powerful number of people. And so what we're doing now is to see those connections being made and recognizing how many of the questions are so very similar. And I think that is teaching us a lesson about how small the world is, but it's also teaching us about some of the things that we can do that we hadn't really thought about. So one of the things, and this is a difficult thing to say in public without it being misconstrued, so take me as I'm intending to say, settlement is difficult. And coming to a new culture is difficult. Moving your entire family after you've already moved and settled into a new place and going to a very different place is tough. And IOM does a fantastic job with cultural orientation, and community groups upon arrival do an extraordinary job helping people to settle in. But it can be confronting when you're being asked to settle into a community that maybe you didn't understand before you signed up, right? You know, you signed the declaration page and your life is going to change. But did we give you enough exposure? And this is something that's in our hands. Do you have enough exposure to the information that you need to make a truly informed decision about what's going to happen when you move down this cycle? So one of the things we're talking about is how we can talk about refugees' obligations to their new societies, refugees thinking about what their lives might be like, really making a decision about how some things might be difficult. So, you know, you're going to go to Sweden, you're going to go to Finland. It's a feminist government. Discuss. That's fine. Here we can have a little titter. But if you're in Bangladesh and you're part of the Rohingya community, that's incredibly confronting. Mm. And it's confronting, it's empowering for some people. I've watched them sitting in the back of the room going, oh, I like that. But they belong to family groups where not everybody is necessarily in agreement. And so what happens when you get to this new country and you're in conflict with everything that this well-meaning community is trying to do? So we have some work to do early on so that people get to make those informed decisions. We have some really difficult discussions to have, I think, in our different communities about how we can link up community-based protection around the world and get a little bit complicated with it. I think it's an opportunity for people who stay behind as well as the ones who leave to have some of those chats and to start to see and recognize, you know, the women leaders in every position. I've never met a more powerful woman than somebody who's come absolutely filthy with her life on her head and her children towing behind. And boy, is she determined to make something of her life in this new village or this new place. I don't care if you're arriving at Sydney Airport or if you're arriving in Minembwe in Eastern Congo. It's the cliche, it is the women holding the societies together. So, you know, what are we doing to make sure that we're weaving that thread all the way through? I think we've made some huge strides, but I think we've got some really big work to do. And we're right at the edge of a genuinely global approach to this. And I think that's super exciting, a bit scary, but something that we need to do.
Yeah, I think, Jackie, what you just shared remind me of a situation that I went through when I arrived to Jacksonville, Florida. Back in 2010, I went through the orientation and I speak English and I am young. I had one kiddo, 1-year-old daughter. My husband found a job and I was walking in the neighborhood trying to get her milk, and I was screamed at and was told to go back home. And a man chased me. That's the first month being in the United States. I did not know how to act. I ran with my child back to the apartment and I did not leave the house for a week. And going back to how women holding things, and that's how I get to do this work. Because if we're not gonna step in and if we're not gonna fight for our kids, for our families, who gonna do it? So I echo that women who hold societies and Thank you so much for listening and for learning. I have a lot to reflect on from this conversation and learned so much. I know that we have 14. Around 10 minutes of questions. Okay, so we have...
We really left a lot of time for them.
Yeah. We were generous,
well,
weren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, but we had really good speakers, so yes. Okay, questions.
My name is Maurice Mukasa. I've been to this country for 6 years. I will start with a positive testimony. 1 year and a half back through CODA Center, I addressed the challenge I had having been received here. With my experience, I've been a prison chaplain for over 20 years. I've been training prison chaplains all over the world, America, Sweden, France. I've been to Geneva. I've been like protecting the rights of others. I was very much concerned about my children that I left in Uganda for the last 6 years, not seeing them, not having peace. However much I'm eating, I'm well looked after. The good news, CODA Center helped me, and we addressed this to the Minister of Immigration, and my children are here. They arrived in October last year. Mm. That's very positive. On contrary, I have a risk assessment to share with you, and I want you to take it seriously. In my capacity as a prison chaplain, I was a member of the policy review in Africa. You talked about Congo. I'm talking about Sudan. I'm talking about those neighboring countries where Uganda is one of the countries hosting the refugees in big capacity, and we appreciate Uganda. However, we are the trouble causer in the region. We fight Congo, we fight Sudan, we cause wars everywhere. In the end, we pretend with a good face of receiving the refugees. How would you advise that? Before I conclude, I am aware of the tension, of the terror, of the sponsored politics from Africa to where countries we go, where Ugandans can't eat from the same plate in the country where they are. Congolese cannot share any secrets in the same community. I'm a leader here in the community. I'm representing the refugees here in the capacity of the those from Africa specifically. I'm representing people with the evidence-based approach. People who are terrorized by fellow Africans, not Australians. I'm talking about ourselves. We carry the weed from Africa, bring it here, practice whatever we used to do there, and sponsored by spies of governments from Africa. It happens in Kenya community, Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda. We are not trusting each other. We are terrorizing ourselves. How are you going to help us? Thank you.
Let's take a couple of questions and maybe we can address it. So three questions. Thank you so much for your question.
Question here.
Hello, my name is Om Dungil. I'm a former refugee from Bhutan. Many of you would have heard about the gross national happiness, the happy country. So I fled Bhutan, leaving behind my two-year-old daughter and my wife, never knowing I would ever see them again, and found happiness down under. So thank you all. We're talking about complementary pathways and the support and success of the complementary pathways. It's very new here in Australia. The success of it will depend a lot on how successful the settlement would be. If we start finding issues, then the support would recede. So I think we would love to listen to you guys for the next couple of hours because it's just amazing. We've got the content experts in the middle and we got the context experts on the side. And you brought so much richness in the conversation. Now, and you did focus on the community. Community is core of everything. Unless we empower communities, a service provider alone cannot do it. So the success of the community settlement program would be very much dependent on communities. How do we, and in your experience, how have you worked with empowering communities so then they can do the right thing? Because oftentimes with the best of intent, we nurture weaknesses, we nurture vulnerability, we nurture trauma, and then magnify that. it's best with the best of intent, but how do we refocus on people's passion and strengths and empower them and make them dependent? So if you are able to share some experience in terms of how we empower communities, we'll really appreciate it. Thank you.
I have a question around agency, since it's come up a little bit, and I hate that I am pointing the questions to you, Mohammed and Basma, but challenging you, Com, and Jackie as well. I live and breathe agency, and I deeply believe that it is what is going to transform the ecosystem and evolve and get us to where we want to go. And at that point, it's going to challenge us again to do better from there. But earlier, Mohammed, you made a mention of those of us within the system trying to change the system from the inside as well as bringing the lived expertise that we have and the lives that don't stop at 5 o'clock. We don't shut our computers and walk away from our jobs and that's the end of it. It continues. It is part of who we are. A question to the two of you, how do you contextualize that? How do you bring in your lived expertise and simultaneously hold space for your professional expertise and at times where you might be expected to separate the two because, you know, it might not be very professional of you to talk a lot about your own personal experiences. And there is no one personal experience that represents every refugee story, right? And then Colm and Jackie, as the other partners in the system, how do you make space for both those expertise to be recognized and valued as assets and contributions to the system?
Thank you. And may I just congratulate all of the speakers. Prior to the rise of complementary protection, resettlement states would overtly or covertly reflect on integration potential in their selection of refugees. I'm interested to find out to what extent has the rise of complementary protection opened space for selection of people with greater vulnerabilities than previously existed?
Great question.
Thank you so much. Okay, so to get in time, we're going to do it that way. I think I already communicated with our speaker what who's going to answer what. So let's start.
Okay, in a way, the first two questions I think can go together. When, you know, we all, everybody in this room relies on state and civil society, state first, civil society in next, to make sure that our human rights are protected, whether that's through the use of institutions or the court system, that, you know, there are layers of protection so that we're able to enjoy our human rights. So ultimately, whether we're talking about people needing to be protected against security issues that are brought together with others who travel with them, or we're talking about people who need to branch out from the world that they've been living in for so long and to start to build their lives again in a healthy and multifaceted way, we need to rely on those systems, right? The people who are facing security needs in Australia need to go to the police, and they need to rely on the police, and they need to insist that the police do the thing that they're supposed to do. That requires civil society, I suspect, in order to make sure that we really are opening up, we're asking the questions, the police are genuinely doing community-based policing, which we're expecting them to do. I think in a similar sort of way, we're looking to communities, we're looking to the society in which people live to be as open as, in fact, we've seen they already are in Australia, so that people can start to see themselves as having many different sides. Yeah, maybe they need to go to a counsellor a couple of times a week in order to deal with some of the trauma, but they also get to go to a cooking class or maybe even offer a sewing class or whatever. People have different skills, people have different parts to their world. And I think one of the things that a third country solution can offer is just that breathing space to be an ordinary human being and not always be, you know, I'm a refugee. On the question on integration criteria, it's less in vogue at the moment, actually, partly because there was a recognition that saying that, you know, that there's no magic formula that if you have three children in a family and five years of education and, you know, this or that other criteria, you're going to be better able to fit into your new society. There are many, many factors that mean that people are going to be more or less easily settled in.
So we're looking at, again, how we do things before folks leave, but also how we work on integration work afterwards so that the integration criteria that we're trying to limit who we were bringing in and did in fact get in the way of choosing the people who had the highest level of vulnerability are starting to change. So just as one example, Canada has decided that women at risk are in fact, that they would prefer to take women at risk who have family members who are male. Yeah, because they say we recognize that male family members may not be able to offer the support that is necessary in the Dadaab refugee camp or, you know, in wherever it is that they've come from. But those same people are going to be essential if that family is going to be able to settle in a reasonable sort of way. So therefore, we are now being encouraged to extend family, the family definition, obviously something that's, you know, that's been at the close of very, very close to UNHCR's heart for a long time, but to make linked cases for resettlement, et cetera, so that extended family can come together and some of those integration criteria just start to fade away. I think complementary pathways gives us the opportunity to narrow. I said that we submitted from 96 operations to 24 countries, 155,000 people. More than half of those operations were submitting people who desperately needed to leave. If we manage to keep open, because we've got complementary pathways, because labor mobility is satisfying some of the extra goals, essentially, of a migration system, but we manage to keep out, it's a small number. We don't need 155,000 dossier submissions. We need a very small number, but we need them to be really functional. I think it is actually giving us the space to do that. It's certainly giving us the space to have those conversations with destination countries. And finally, one of the things I think that you mentioned earlier, you know, how do we expand the space for the number of countries that are involved in this? One of the things that complementary pathways does is to allow countries that really don't have the social services that allow for persons with medical needs or, you know, high levels of support needs to take on refugees to their country because the community is able to look after the integration requirements of somebody who already has a job upon arrival. So right. We're seeing in the Americas particularly a real interest in Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay, countries that already have hundreds of thousands of refugees, by the way, but really want to contribute to what's happening around the world. They recognize that they can't take people with acute protection or medical needs, but they are actually interested in giving people the opportunity to come on a work visa and then to use their community sponsorship program to allow them to have that opportunity to settle and to integrate with the needs that they have for integration, not the full package, but the thing that's pointed. By the way, Community Sponsorship Fund, watch this space. We're trying to get money from the wealthy world to the less wealthy world so that exactly that opportunity can be taken forward. Sorry, advertising that.
I mean, she answered many of the questions in one. So Colm, I
want to try and give a perspective on Shabnam's question, because I think it's such an important one about what do we need to do within the system. I mean, I'm going to tell you what I heard from the question and what it got me thinking about. In a very different context, I have experience of operating in a professional system as an expert by experience, where there were many potential judgments coming at me because I was a person with lived experience, right? So that there was a vulnerability that was attached. There was or if I expressed something that was somewhat unprofessional, or there was an intensity to what might be communicated. I think one of the things that we need to do within the system is get over ourselves and see the person as fully who they are, and understand and recognize that if somebody is presenting based, we just need to be able to let people. It's very hard to operate within a system coming from a lived experience perspective if you're always having to watch and be careful about, am I being appropriate? Am I being professional? We create those expectations. We create those kinds of challenges. I've never met in a context in which we were working together to develop solutions, anybody come from a lived experience perspective who wasn't entirely appropriate in whatever was being presented. Because what I mean is nobody is always appropriate, but you know what I mean.
But refugees get to stuff up too.
But that's actually what I'm trying to say, and saying really badly, right? We need to allow people to be fully human in who they are and bring themselves to it. And in bringing all of their lived experience perspective, some of that will be challenging, some of it will be provocative, some of it will be uncomfortable, some of it will be deeply insightful, and all of it needs to be valued and all of it needs to be facilitated and seen. Sorry.
And I mean, really just to, it's a great point. And I think, and just to sort of add, I think, because you mentioned around the fact that we don't get to close shop when we go home, and then that's a real one. You know, I don't get to take that hat off when I go home. And I often say that, you know, my colleagues might think of their job as work. I this for me is a mission. I am on a mission. I'm on a mission not because I am a refugee. I want to be really, really clear about that. Those are biographical details. You can find that out in any which way you might want, in any which way. I do this work as a refugee because I know what abandonment feels like. I know what loss feels like. I know what losing your family feels like. I know what it feels like to be a refugee. I don't do it because I am a refugee. That's my why. And I think we focus on the technicalities and the biographical realities of that experience, thinking that is the thing that keeps us upright and gives us that sense of agency. That doesn't give me agency. That puts me in a really dark past. Why would I want to be there, right? And so I think that sort of my ability to be able to operate in those domains, I think early in my career, much to your point, I think I really did separate personally. I separated the world that I came from versus the world that I operated in, right? But I started to realize over the course of my career that the ace in my cards were actually, I can activate the aces in my back pocket if I narrowed the delta between the two. And I think to Jackie's point earlier, when you can untangle your lived experience and really begin to think about it through the lens of a policy framework, as at least I can do in my own position in chair, I think that really, I think, is able to make strong advocacy arguments and points to do the case making that I think is really, really necessary to be able to move that needle forward. At the end of the day, I am here to solve the problems, right? I'm not really very much interested in the pontificating. Right. And I think for me, I want to be put in positions, and I think refugees want to be mechanisms to be established for us to be able to help solve those problems, which, by the way, are shared. These are shared problems. Yeah. This as much afflicts us as it does you. And this isn't us them sort of I'm not trying to create that kind of diagram here, but it really is a shared purpose and a shared problem. And if we see it that way, and fundamentally, we don't think of this as a complement to the system because we see it as central to the process around some of that problem solving.